This is an ABC podcast.
In 1898, Jack Quinn and his blue kelpie, Coyle, travel from Cootamundra to Sydney to compete in the annual sheepdog trials. Coyle did brilliantly in his first trial. He scored a perfect 100. But that night, when Coyle and Jack were heading back to their lodgings, Coyle jumped out of the horse-drawn carriage and he got his leg all smashed up in one of its wheels. That night, Jack reset Coyle's leg and dressed it in a cork splint. Now, any regular dog would have curled up with a bone feeling a bit sorry for itself, but not Coyle. The next day, Jack and Coyle turned back up at the showgrounds for the second run, and Coyle once again scored a perfect 100. He rounded up his sheep and got them in the pen in just 6 minutes and 12 seconds, and he did it on 3 legs. He became a huge star, with the newspapers christening him the Immortal Coyle. My guest on Conversations today is Guy Hull. Guy is a dog behaviourist, he's managed dog shelters, and he has, it's fair to say, an encyclopedic knowledge of dog breeds and their histories. His book is The Dogs That Made Australia, and I spoke to Guy last year. Hi, Guy.
Hello, Sarah.
Is Coyle one of your favourite dogs, then, from this history?
He is. He's probably my favourite Australian dog. There's a few of them, but the most famous Australian dogs are Kelpies, so there's a hall of fame, really, of Kelpies, famous Kelpies we could choose from, but he's pretty much a standout, isn't he?
You've got a really beautiful picture of Coyle shepherding a little tiny chicken into a jam jar. So it's not that he could be rough and ready. He was had to have all that kind of tenderness that a great Kelpie has, I guess.
Well, they got that finesse. The Kelpie's got that finesse that it can do that kind of work. Tinning a chicken. Yeah, that was called tinning the chicken, and it was a popular way of showing a dog's finesse and skill with, you know, obviously small animals. It was a pretty popular thing for quite a while.
So do you have a Kelpie yourself now?
No, I'm not that fortunate, I'm afraid, Sarah. I've got a I'm a bit of a masochist. I've got a Pharaoh hound now.
What's that?
Well, they're the Maltese rabbit dog. Their native name is a Kelptal Fennec, the dog of the rabbit, but they're likened to the Egyptian god Anubis, so they've got those erect ears, and they're the ancestor of all the running hounds. So yes, I own Giuseppe, but he's not very Kelpie obedient, I'm afraid.
Why did you choose that of all the dog breeds?
Well, like why I've made some other difficult decisions in my life. Well, I have a Maltese mother, so an Australian father, Anglo-Australian father, and a Maltese mother, and it's a bit of a connection. It's the national dog of Malta, so after owning, you know, I own cattle dogs for decades and decades, and, you know, they're sort of, you can go on autopilot with those things. They're pretty obedient once you got them under control. So I just thought I'd do the heritage thing and got Giuseppe. I'm still paying for it every day.
What sort of different techniques do you need with Giuseppe?
Well, you have to be consistently firm, and you can't cut him too much slack. He's a hard-driven hunting dog. So hounds are dogs that hunt by themselves, independent of people, in cooperation with people, but independent of people, and whereas gun dogs hunt, you know, in cooperation with a hunter. Well, Giuseppe's got it in his head that he should go off roaming for as long as he wants and chase whatever he wants, and we can't have that, not particularly when you're walking around telling everyone else how their dog should be behaving. So,
well, what does Giuseppe try to get?
Oh, he rabbits. He looks everywhere for rabbits, and he hates rats. He hates dirty rats, in fact. So he's a bit tuned into the rodents at the moment. So he's either sleeping, cleaning himself, or hunting, one of the three. So.
Of course, when we think about Australia and Australian dogs, we think about dingoes as being a native dog. But have they been here as long as people have been here?
No. People have been here for about 60,000 years thereabouts. You know, the figures vary. The dingo arrived about between 3,500 to 5,000 years ago. So it's a new addition, but it re-established the natural order here. It re-established the environment. The thylacine and the devil were the main mainland carnivores at the time.
So Tasmanian tigers and devils were here on the mainland?
Yeah, absolutely, throughout the mainland. But not long after the dingo arrived, they declined quite a great deal. And look, science is now saying, look, advances in weapon development, hunting weapon development, and, you know, a bit of a population explosion with indigenous people would have been the cause of that, but the dingoes would have been out competing there. They would have moved the goalposts on those two predators. So the thylacine and the devil only survived in Tasmania, where they were, the Bass Strait separated and the dingo couldn't make it across there. So,
well, how did dingoes get to Australia?
Well, they came with people, an intrepid people called the Peta people, who started from Central Asia and eventually colonised all Melanesia and Polynesia. So they swept by the... They only liked islands. They seemed to avoid large land masses. So... But they know now, DNA testing has established now, that probably just one pair arrived in Australia around about 5,000 years. Yeah, it's incredible. And so they came as domestic dogs. So that Asian dog, so about 15,000 years ago, thereabouts, in central China, something happened to some wolves over there that they fundamentally changed and became a dog. Now, a dog is a canine that's dependent or codependent on humans. So for some reason, it was probably hunger, some wolves decided they wanted to start cozying up to people, and they probably might have been small or injured or, misformed. And as a result, over a period of time, they were tamed and then they were domesticated. We've never the theory, and it would have been women who did that, because women have the food. Women have that maternal instinct and would Gronk with his spear coming home from hunting for the day wouldn't have been too happy to see those things hanging around the camp. So it would have been the ladies that did that, and dogs love women more than men these days anyway. Having managed shelters, I can tell you that most dogs that are fearful that come into the shelter are fearful of either men or children or big people, all right? So women generally have a closer bond with dogs. You go to dog shows, it's 99% women there. You look at people doing dog activities, you go for a walk along the beach and most of those people are women. So there's a great affinity between women and dogs, and I don't think that's been recognised to the extent that it is. But the long and the short of it is no one has ever domesticated the wolf and no one's ever domesticated the dingo. So that wolf did need to change before it could become a domestic dog.
So, but when those little puppies, those Asian dogs, arrived in Australia 4,000 years or so ago, it's amazing to think of, because Aboriginal people, I guess, had never seen this strange animal before. How did they live with them? Did they take them into their camps? What happened?
Yeah, they would have taken them into the camps. And see, the thing is, the dog played the role of a kingmaker throughout the world. Wherever the dog went, people went, they were able to establish agrarianism, capture domestic animals and maintain them, guard their properties. But the Indigenous people in Australia didn't need the dog to help it get along. They've been doing fine for, 60,000 years before the dog arrived. So they would have loved them as pets. They probably would have been puppies that they were given, and they would have loved that. Everyone loves a puppy, and they would have enjoyed, the fun of a small puppy. But then, like in any home, if you don't put the work in when they're small, when they grow into teenagers, at about 6 months of age, you wish they would leave home. So those little dogs would have started learning to take care of themselves and provide for themselves to the point that they became semi-feral, which is what happens with a domestic dog today. If you don't look after your dog and you're not feeding him, he'll go and find food for himself. So
did Aboriginal people use dingoes for hunting?
No. No, the dingo doesn't have any cooperative ability about it. They probably could have helped. They probably would have been helping finding small game like echidnas and animals in hollows and, in bottoms of trees and things, or in burrows. But you couldn't imagine Aboriginal men going out for a long, quiet, painstaking stalk on kangaroos to have the dogs run in there and mess things up for them. So we had a lot of American anthropologists over in Australia doing most of our work early on in the piece. And there's a clear distinction between what a dog will do and what a dingo will do or won't do. And those lines were blurred a lot. They were there to look at people and didn't really understand anything about dogs. So those stories about them being Aboriginal hunting companions is just not right.
Did dingoes hunt kangaroos for their own use?
Oh, absolutely.
And what did they know then about how to safely hunt a kangaroo? Well, what kind of kangaroo should you hunt if you're a dingo?
A small one. A very small one. A slow, small one. Well, dingoes are known. Dingoes are probably the most adaptable canine that there is. So if they're out looking after small game, they'll hunt by themselves. So they'll pack up when they need to pack up. So they would obviously try, and like any predator, would probably try and find the weakest, oldest, slowest in a mob. But unlike, a lot of other herbivores that pack up together and mob up together when they're being threatened. Kangaroos just spread in every direction. So there's not the whole herd to chase. They're just chasing individuals. So they try and chase them in circles and do it in relays, chase them round in a big circle, another one will take over. And does will throw, under pressure, will throw their, pick their joeys up and throw them out of the pouch and like into a bush or something. And they'd probably stop and grab a lot of those as well. But it's just, it was a really a war of attrition hunting. Hunting kangaroos head for rough country when they're being pursued, being caught, so.
And maybe even into dams.
Oh, they go into water all the time. And
what if a dog follows them they'll either stand on them
or grab them with their front, where they, you know, like that we call their arms, and bite them savagely. But generally they'll stand on them and drown them. And a lot of dogs have been killed by that. But the early colonists, which we'll get to later, noticed that the kangaroos had that strategy and tried to keep their dogs away from that.
Well, when the English began arriving in Australia, Guy, did they bring many dogs with them?
Well, they didn't bring a lot. They brought the manifests on the first fleet said that the only dogs that they listed were assorted puppies and the governor's greyhounds. Now, we know that those assorted puppies now were some small spaniels, like Cavalier King Charles type spaniels, little toy spaniels, and some little terriers, which they would have brought over for vermin control, would have been handy on the ships as well. But they brought what they generically term greyhounds, and in that you're looking at your standard smooth-coated English greyhound, and we do know that they brought some wire-haired greyhounds with them. Now, that was either the Scottish Deerhound, which is a larger version of the greyhound, smaller than an Irish wolfhound, a rough, wire-coated dog, and a more heavily built dog, a larger, more heavily built dog. But they may well have also had the Scotch wire-haired greyhound, which is a cross between the greyhound and the deerhound. But nonetheless, no matter where, we don't know exactly which ones they brought. They just referred to everything as greyhounds. But we know that they were running short of food and they needed to supplement their rations, increase their protein intake. So they started coursing those greyhounds on kangaroos and found that the wire-haired versions were by far the hardiest dog for that job.
How dangerous was it, though, for those English dogs unused to kangaroos and unused to Australian conditions to go hunting kangaroos?
Well, it was very dangerous for the ones first starting. But dogs are incredibly intelligent and incredibly adaptable. So they soon learnt the way to handle kangaroos mostly. So that would be, they generally run a pair, and a bitch, being smaller than dogs, faster, but not as powerful. She would normally get up beside a kangaroo, and when they're on the up leash, she'd grab it right by the butt of the tail and drive it into the ground, and the male would then and hold it down. Because once the tail's immobilised, kangaroos have a hard job doing anything. Their sense of balance is right out. And then the male would come up and grab and seize them by the back of the neck and dispatch the kangaroo then. But they were losing dogs, a lot of dogs all the time, and it got worse as time went on because some people and some dogs are more skilled than others.
So did the English start breeding dogs specifically for hunting kangaroos?
Oh, yeah, they certainly did that. They needed any settler. So after the second fleet arrived and brought an improvement in rations for them, people on the land, small settlers, were still dependent on living off the land because stock was precious. You had to conserve your stock and increase your numbers. So people were still living off the land. So anywhere anyone settled, the kangaroo dog was an essential tool for them. And unfortunately, those dogs are a lovely, big, sentimental dog, but they were only viewed as a tool. No one had any great love for them, you know.
So what is a kangaroo dog? Is it a breed between certain dogs
It's generally a cross, accepted. Well, I call them staghounds these days, and that name's incorrect, but a kangaroo dog is generally a cross. There's variations, but it's generally a cross between a smooth greyhound and an Irish deerhound. So they'll throw both smooth-coated dogs and rough-coated dogs, but the wire-coated dogs are preferred because their skin's thicker. Their paw pads are also thicker on those dogs, so that the Australian bush is a very dangerous place and a lot of broken branches and stumps everywhere. So they mostly stuck with the wire-coated varieties. But, look, people were throwing anything in them at times. So I basically stuck with the main ingredient, which is deerhound and greyhound in this story. But some people were crossing them with Irish wolfhounds and using them to course dingoes with.
So they had to be big enough to hunt a kangaroo, but obedient. And I mean, I guess there are certain qualities that made them good for hunting kangaroos.
Yeah. Well, the qualities that they needed was the ability to run fast in rough country. So they needed to be bigger than your average greyhound. They needed to be more strongly constructed. And they needed to obviously be a bigger dog, so they were capable of killing quicker. But those advantages in size were also disadvantages when a kangaroo bailed up. The dogs weren't as quick. They couldn't get around them, pull them down. So a lot of them were lost in those struggles, you know, when the kangaroo wasn't held properly. And lots of them in Tasmania, they were losing hundreds of dogs.
My guest on Conversations today is Guy Hull, who's written The Dogs That Made Australia. And Guy spent much of his life working with dogs in different capacities. Well, tell me about Tasmania and the early history of dogs there. So he said that there weren't dingoes there in Tasmania, that they'd been confined to the mainland. So when kangaroo dogs were introduced to Tasmania, what did that mean for the wildlife that was there?
Well, it's just bad news for the environment, really. Well, anyone knew visiting Van Diemen's Land was bad news for the place, and starting from the people and finishing with the dogs and their stock, really. But it was a different story in Van Diemen's Land. In Van Diemen's Land, they established two colonies, one down at Hobart, down on the Derwent in the south, and the other one on the Tamar River, which we call Launceston now, but was Port Dalrymple. After David Collins, who was the lieutenant governor down there, was the judge advocate in Sydney Cove for the First Fleet. So he'd been through all that privation of that First Fleet. So he was very panicky about everyone starving. They thought they were starving, but they weren't starving.
What do you mean?
Well, they thought they were short on rations, and they thought they were starving, but it never...
Around them there's this natural plenty too, I'm guessing.
Yeah. all there for the raping. So what they decided to do, Collins decided that he'd send officers out with their... Because a lot of officers took their kangaroo dogs down with them, running hounds down with them. So he sent those fellows out to course, but they soon... there was plenty of food for everyone. They didn't have any starvation problems, but that fed everyone around both those settlements. But, you know, the rule to hunting pressure is the more you hunt locally, the further you've got to go, because you wipe everything out and everything makes off to get away from you. So there's that wide open, almost treeless strip right there through the centre of that island called the Midlands. So they started venturing out into the Midlands, but the Palawa, the indigenous people of the island, were pretty unhappy about what was going on. So they were... They were to be found out in the Midlands, and the officers didn't like the thought of having to mix with them. So they decided they'd do one of the dumbest decisions that's ever been made, and they gave the convicts firearms and dogs and sent them out in the bush and said, be a good fellow and go and hunt kangaroos for us all week. We'll see you on Friday with all your meat. They crossed their fingers and waved goodbye to them.
What happened?
Well, we've got a bush ranger problem out of that. That's what happened. We drove the Tasmanian emu to this extinction in a couple of years, and the forester kangaroo was driven, you know, over a series of years out of the Midlands, driven to extinction. And the Palawa people were driven to extinction because all their food was gone, and you know, the thylacine and the devil and all the native animals were just about driven to extinction. So it was the great Vandemonian dream for the colonists, but it wasn't so very pleasant for any of the native inhabitants that were there in the first place.
And what about those dogs that first of all, the officers and then the bushrangers were taking out, I mean, into this, again, pretty harsh landscape? Was there anything that they could do for their dogs to help protect them when they were out hunting kangaroos?
No, not really. There was no medical treatment available. So if a dog, and look, there's excerpts, well, I quote excerpts from people who say, you know, like every day our dogs are getting ripped up, you know, they're being disemboweled and we've got to carry them home and some of them don't make it. Any of those bush rangers with an injured dog, they just would have shot those dogs if they couldn't get them through. They just couldn't, you know, wouldn't have been able to care for those.
What about using kangaroo skins as a collar or a shoes? Did some owners try that for their dogs?
Look, some of the kinder bush rangers, while they were...
It's a very particular subtype.
Yeah, you love dogs. some of those might have gone to that extreme. But shoeing dogs has been a traditional thing in coursing and running dogs. But some dogs can tolerate them, some dogs can't stand them. So, you know, though dogs hunting in this country wear their paw pads out pretty quickly, they would just rest those dogs up for a while. But Some of those dogs won't even rest. You know, it doesn't matter. Like a Kelpie, they can just be running on stumps, like Coyle. Just not broken legs are not going to bother some dogs.
As well as the bushrangers and the officers in Tasmania, there were, of course, these convict settlements, the convict prisons at Macquarie Harbour and then at Port Arthur. Yes. How were dogs used to try and prevent convict escapees at Port Arthur?
Well, an ensign, a marine ensign named Peyton Jones, devised a dog line across Eagle Hawk Neck, which is a very narrow, sandy stretch of land that separates Port Arthur on that peninsula from the mainland. So he conceived this idea to every 3 or 4 metres to chain a dog under a lamppost with a wine barrel keg for a kennel, and covered the area with cockle shells, with pippy shells, so they could hear anyone approaching and it would reflect light. So there were no successful escape attempts while that dog line was there. It would have been a disgusting way to keep those poor dogs. Those things would have been insane. They were really, really savage.
So just chained all the time.
Continually chained, and also built platforms above the water so they could, at low tide, they could chain them, you know, below the high water mark to stop people getting past. So they had some convict drew the very short straw and had to feed and water those dogs and clean up after them. But there was no successful escape attempts, but there were a couple of notable escape attempts, but none successful.
Well, tell me about one of those. Tell me about the trick that convict Billy Hunt tried.
Well, poor Billy. Billy was an escape artist and mastermind. So Billy collected kangaroo skins and made himself his own kangaroo outfit.
Why would have that been a smart way to get past a bunch of dogs that are really good at eating kangaroos?
Well, no one's been able to rationalise Billy's motives, I'm afraid, Sarah. But so Billy dressed himself up and
as a kangaroo,
and was hopping, like properly hopping, towards the dog line. So the guards in the guard barracks saw the kangaroo and thought that they would shoot the kangaroo because they had muskets and they may well have been hungry. And everyone was used to eating marsupial down there. So relying on military rations, they probably would have been hungry. So he started shooting at the kangaroo, who threw his arms in the air and said, "Oh, stop, it's just me, Billy Hunt." It's like, "Truly, Bill? Like, is that really you?" So Billy threw his hands in the air and gave up and was readmitted back to Port Arthur. He didn't make it through. But some people did try and swim for it. Martin Cash, the bushranger, did escape, but we think it was before the dog line by swimming. But then they told the convicts that a shark called Government Billy was patrolling the waters looking for convicts trying to swim for it. So everyone was too scared to go in. So they stayed on their side of the line.
What sort of dogs were used in that line, do you know?
Well, look, there's a monument down there that shows a mastiff type. It looks like a dog de Bordeaux. It looks like the French mastiff with tail dock. There are diagrams of the dog line that are still existent, and they were wire haired. They were just a mix of everything. They were what they call a band dog. They were like the poor man's mastiff, anything large and aggressive. In the Midlands, you know, the wars were going on with the convicts, there was wars going on with the Indigenous people. So the settlers needed protection around the home. So there were a lot of those big dogs down in Van Diemen's Land at the time. So they just press ganged. They probably went around and found the worst, nastiest ones they could find and chained them all up there. So it would have been awful, really.
Back on the mainland, Guy, sheep farming was starting to take off in a big way. What did the presence of all of those delectable sheep mean for dingoes and the way that dingoes behaved?
Well, it was just a big smorgasbord had come to town, Sarah. The thing is that with the brilliant strategy of the colonists was to come in, wipe out all the food supply of the Indigenous people and the dingoes and the predators.
So getting rid of culling kangaroos.
Oh, culling kangaroos and, you know, or anything that would compete with domestic stock, or anything that would graze on, you know, corn, sweet corn and wheat and any other crops that were growing out Rose Hill and Parramatta along the Hawkesbury. So they this brilliant strategy to get rid of everything that the natives rely on, then start killing the natives when they start turning to your introduced food. So it was an easy, really easy to kill and addictive animal for the dingo, the sheep. So they started, and it's a fattier meat. It's probably, you know, it's probably more appetizing for them as well. And they've developed that surplus killing. It's just like serial killers. They just
Well, what do you mean? Like, if they were killing kangaroos, they just kill enough that they needed for one meal.
Oh, well, there's a big job in killing one kangaroo. I mean, you just don't walk up. They can walk up to a mob of sheep and just run up to them and just kill one. If they started to get a kangaroo, unless they got really lucky, there was hours in that. And there's a lot of, you know, they'd expend a lot of energy doing that. So they'd kill the kangaroo and eat to satiation and then sleep, basically. But they developed this surplus killing thing, which they still do now, and feral dogs do it as well. So they'll run after a sheep. The sheep will break from the safety of the pack, and it's as good as dead once it does that, and run after them and bite them, tear chunks of skin and flesh off them. They can kill and then eat, and then they'll get up and start doing it again, start chasing again. So they just don't stop with one, which is, unfortunately, you know, there's people, you know, who are, you know, have a strong bond with their stock, and it's a terrible thing. But even back then, today, now, people are, you know, graziers are struggling to try and cope with that disaster.
So dingoes or feral dogs would maul a sheep, not even necessarily eat the whole thing, and then just go on to the next
Absolutely.
One and the next one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One after the other, after the other. And there are some dingoes that don't know any other way. They're just raised preying on sheep.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Konofsky on ABC Radio. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So, Guy, when the British started farming here in Australia with cattle and with sheep, what sort of dogs did they bring from home to work on the farms?
Well, they didn't bring anything for a while. There's really no record of any stock working dogs coming on the First Fleet, which is a bit incredible, really, considering the problems that they had. They walked into a dingo pack, essentially, and they didn't keep their dogs under control. They didn't bring any British stock with them. They stopped at the Cape of Good Hope and picked up some Cape sheep, which were just a meat breed, but they were soon decimated. But when they started importing British sheep and cattle, they started importing literally from the same farms, the dogs that were working that stock over there. So when they brought sheep, the Teeswater sheep were one of the first breeds that came over. They brought literally the dogs from the farms that were working. So a shepherd accompanied them on the ship that came over, and he brought his dogs, keep them under control all the way down to the docks. So those dogs were mostly collie types, all right? They were shepherding dogs. So they were dogs used to working with one man with maybe 50, 100 sheep, quiet sheep. They were generally easy to manage. Now, with the cattle dogs, they brought a dog called the Bobtail, which was a progenitor of the Old English sheepdog. The Old English sheepdog has always been a cattle dog. It's not a sheepdog. But that's the way some breeds get named. So
they bought out dogs that were used to farm
doing that job
in England or Scotland. How
yes.
did they go here?
Not very well.
Well, what was the toughest bit for those dogs?
Well, the ground, their feet, and, you know, and their coats, because they were from that cold climate, and they were heavily coated animals, and, you know, they're full of sticks and burrs and mud and ticks and, like, have fun pulling finding a paralysis tick on one of those dogs. So with all the things that beset our dogs here, all those health issues, including having a really, really hard schedule, because those cattle that were brought over soon went wild because there was no fencing. There were generally no small holdings once they started getting into industrial, like, beef cattle. So the dogs that they needed for that, we just couldn't do the job. They were known to be good cattle dog, droving dogs. So they were essentially the sheepdogs were collies, the gathering type that would bring sheep towards a person, and the cattle dogs were droving types, were used to pushing stock. When the stock doesn't want to play the game and your dogs need to get them to behave, you need a pretty hard dog for that. Those dogs weren't hard enough for that.
Well, tell me about the role that a father and son, old Jack and young Jack Timmins, played in the development of an Australian working dog.
Well, we got a 50% strike rate with the Timminses because old Jack wasn't much help to anyone at all, really. He was transported for political crimes. He was a member of the United Irishmen. There was a botched uprising. He was transported to New South Wales, was of exemplary behaviour, and was released and took up as a driver, and he was driving from Bathurst across the Blue Mountains down into the Hawkesbury Valley and then on into Sydney. Now,
that's a long way for cattle to travel.
It's a long way, and there's no feed in those mountains. It's, you know, well, it was a pretty hard gig, that one. So it wasn't to be underestimated. Although it's not all that far, you know, 150 miles or something. It's a tough job, and there's other travellers on the roads, and you're trying to get these. That convict road was built in 6 months by, you know, a handful of convicts, but it was only 12 feet wide. So it would have been, you know, an ordeal getting cattle through there.
And I guess also once your cattle, you're wanting them to be in good condition to sell on at a good price. But if they've just done that walk with not enough feed, they're not going to look so crash hot.
And also depending on what sort of condition they were when he picked them up, they might not have been in good nick anyway. So he had to pay, like all drivers, if you start losing stock, you've got to pay. It comes out of your earnings. So he needed a better dog. So he was using these bobtails. They were a big, heavy, heavy-coated dog, and crossed them with a dingo and called them a red bobtail.
How would he have done that? How do you cross a dog, given that dingoes aren't tame and that you said how difficult a dingo is once it stops being a pup? How on earth would he have successfully bred them?
I think he just would have left them to it, I think, Sarah. They would have worked it out themselves. But he probably tied out a one of his bobtail bitches, and she was probably, you know, where out in the bush where there was water for her, and she would have been, you know, serviced by a dingo sire. He certainly didn't keep them. We know that there's no record of him keeping dingoes. And the Hawkesbury was also a sheep area, so the local sheep people wouldn't have been happy with anyone keeping dingoes, and they wouldn't have been very happy with that first cross, his red bobtails.
Well, what were they like?
Well, they were a disaster. They just attacked stock straight away.
So, more dingo than bobtail.
Yeah, well, more naughty dog than anything. They were just uncontrolled, and so poor old Jack Timmons, I think, my opinion is that he just tried to get away with that on his first cross, and it didn't work. And it may well have, you know, that crossing may well have worked over a period of years of back crossing and, you know, selective breeding. It may well have worked, but there would be too much. You know, the dingo doesn't have any working ability, so they would have used the dingo to enhance the durability of that working dog and give it, you know, a hardiness for Australian conditions. It had all of that, but it didn't have any work, they weren't under any control, and they killed stock, attacked calves and killed stock, and we're pretty sure that they were just dispatched straight away. Well, you'd want to.
Did other farmers try to crossbreed dogs with dingoes?
Oh, look, yeah, probably. We don't really know. We only know of a couple of cases, and the prominent case was the Hall family, who were Northumbrian immigrants, so from northern England, and they were from a cattle-raising family. So George Hall started a series of properties on the Hawkesbury, and then eventually owned a string of stations that went all the way to Surat in central Queensland. And his boast was that his boys could ride from central Queensland to Sydney and camp on their own land every day. That might have been a bit of a stretch, but that's what the claim was. And it's probably the model that Sir Sidney Kidman used for his cattle empire that stretched from Darwin down to Adelaide, and further. So the Halls brought over Durham cattle, which the family bred in Northumbria. With those cattle, they brought a dog called a drover's cur. Now, cur is a name generally for a tailless dog, a dog that avoided the dog tax by having its tail docked. The curs
why,
were...
Sorry, why do you avoid the dog tax if you have the tail docked?
Well, there was a tax earlier on, there was a tax on dogs in England, but working dogs were exempt. So to mark them as being working dogs, they had to dock their tail. So the Halls brought... the Halls were known to have blue-speckled and blue-coloured curs. Now, the Hall family historians in England have confirmed that. There's no question now that Thomas Hall brought over those curs. They were imported, exported with their cattle and imported into New South Wales. And we know that he used the dingo. Now, crossing that dog, the cur, with the dingo gave him two types of heeler. They were called Hall's heeler first up. The first type was one that was very dingoish, looked like a blue or a red version, the cattle dog we all know and some of us love, with a brush tail. So it's a rectangular in profile with a bushy tail brush like a dingo. The other type that developed a few years later, because Hall needed to back cross to the cur all the time to keep those working genes there and to lessen the influence of the dingo. Eventually, a squarish in profile dog with a naturally bobbed tail began to appear. Now, when Thomas Hall died in 1870, his dogs became available. So from about 1820 to about 1870, those dogs were only owned privately by the Halls.
They wouldn't sell them?
No, no, no one was allowed to own them. So they're a privately owned breed, and which is an incredible thing to think. When you look in retrospect, Thomas Hall would be one of the greatest developers of any breed of dog the world's ever seen, really. He produced two types of dog. They were way ahead of their competitors because of their dogs. Their dogs had all the dingo's durability, but had all the curs working, hard-wired for working.
How rough could they be with a bullock, say, that was not behaving the way they'd want?
They could be extremely... That's a leading question, Sarah. They could be extremely forceful.
Which bits of the bullock might they...
Anything that dangled, really, was likely to be was likely to be fastened upon, and which caused the beast to turn somersaults, as you would. But so they were hard dogs for hard stock. Those stock were... The Halls lost 200 head at one stage. Somewhere around the Breezer Plain, Bert Howard reckons. Losing that 200 stock would have been the straw that broke the camel's back, and he said, listen, we just need to get better dogs. Those dogs established that empire. Those dogs gave beef production in Australia, well, in New South Wales then, and then in southern Queensland, a big head start over their competitors overseas. The dogs saved a whole lot of people. The Halls used assigned convict labour for a fair while, but you'd only need a few stockmen with a large mob. So, but when the rail started reaching these pastoral regions, the same time that wire fencing came in, the situation reversed then, Sarah. Cattle that were wild out in paddocks and hardly ever handled were then contained in smaller paddocks. Graziers got around them more often, they quietened down. Sheep, on the other hand, were shepherded, you know, like 50 to 100 by one man and a slow old collie just poking around them, doing their work. They were liberated into huge paddocks, you know, monstrous, hundreds of miles in area, those paddocks, and they became wild. So we needed a less forceful cattle dog, but a more able sheepdog. So Australia's collie then developed after the decline of the horse heeler.
And so when you need this sort of different sort of dog to deal with sheep, did farmers try to breed one specifically the way they did for a dog to work with cattle?
Look, so we all know that collies are the best sheepdogs, all right? There's some other working breeds that aren't collies, but nothing generally works as good as a collie. But there have been lots of different kinds of collies. And back then, see, we've got these big macro breeds now. We've got these big maxi breeds now. But back then, there were all these micro breeds everywhere. Every farm had their own version of something. And in England or in the United Kingdom, you travel 5 miles and you're looking at a different version of a type or a breed. But the Scottish working collie was the dog that they generally brought over here, which was a dog not unsimilar to a border collie, but generally it was black and tan. The border collie hadn't been developed then. Border collie didn't really appear as a breed until early in the 20th century, 1902. So the Scottish working collies they brought over were fine. They were doing the job and they were, you know, quite good sheepdogs, and they were winning sheepdog trials when they began. But they still had heavy in coat. They still had those problems and rose ears. They still had problems that weren't suitable to the Australian environment. The premier collie breeders in Scotland was a family named the Rutherfords. Now, Gideon Rutherford was a great stockman and a dog man, and his son Richard Rutherford really advanced his breeding program of breeding working collies. His brother, John Rutherford, emigrated to Australia and got into pastoralism, was a very, very successful man. Richard Rutherford started sending short-haired, erect-eared working collies to Australia for this cartel of Scottish-Australian farmers who were known to him. Now, he was specifically breeding those for Australia. What the mystery outcross is the question. What dog, short-haired, erect-eared dogs, like the Kelpie, basically we're talking about the Kelpie, are unknown in Scotland, all right? But they were there for a while. He developed these dogs for over a few years and we know that he sent a few litters out of these dogs. That would have been enough for them to integrate into the other working collie gene pool that was here, because they disappeared from Rutherford's establishment in Scotland after a while. So nothing more is known of them. So it was a deliberate program to help his brother out. He said, listen, we need them short-coated, we need them erect-eared, we don't need all this superfluous
coat. How is the erect ear helpful?
Well, that's a really, really important, that's a very interesting question. The erect ear is helpful is because a dog that is rectangular in profile with a full tail and erect ears is a primitive type. You think of, well, I'll give you some examples. We'll look at some of the Spitz breeds, Alaskan Malamute. That's an extreme version of it, the Siberian Husky. There's the Dingo. There's the Cattle Dog. These are all primitive dogs. A cattle dog's still a Spitz, and Dingo is one of the Spitz breeds. It's just a descendant of those northern dogs. So those working erect ears are far better at picking up sound. So when you're working on a property where the dog could be a long way away, it's much more helpful for that dog. It can hear you moving around. It can hear you driving or calling out the stock. So it makes the dog a better long-range working proposition. So that type, that the Kelpie eventually developed into that type, you've got to remember they all developed during the years of the Federation drought, which was a terrible drought that went for about 7 years in Australia.
Well, tell me how Jack Gleeson got involved or is important in the development of transforming these Scottish Collies into Kelpies.
Well, Jack Gleeson had the luck of the Irish. Jack Gleeson was an itinerant stockman and ended up down at Casterton, and he was working on the property next door to where a man named George Robertson took receipt of a litter of these Rutherford Collies. And George Robertson and his nephew had agreed that none of those puppies were going to be, well, not going to move off any of those puppies till they saw how good they were. Jack Gleeson had a very beautiful stock horse, which George Robertson's nephew coveted. So they did a surreptitious animal swap on the banks of the Glenelg River one night.
Well, so Jack Gleeson got the collie pup and
yes.
Mr. Robertson got Jack's horse.
Yes, and Jack Gleeson ran away then with his ran away with his dog and headed north, made off with all haste. But, so yeah, he nicked off with, and they called her Kelpie that one. So that was, they called her Gleeson's Kelpie. Now Jack Gleeson.
So Kelpie was the name of an individual dog.
Yes. The Kelpies are mythical Scottish water horses. They're actually like horses, and they, you know, they devour you if you go down near the river, you know. So particularly if you're in love with a beautiful maiden, you walk down near the river, you're both going to get eaten by the Kelpies. But so they named her after this mythical creature. And so Jack Gleeson, whether he called her that or the Robertsons called her that, we don't know, but she became known as Gleeson's Kelpie. But she wasn't entirely smooth-coated. She did have some longer coat on her. So he travelled north, and then by chance he met one of the Rutherfords' old friends and neighbours from Scotland, the Tullys, and Mark Tully. The Tullys had their Rutherford dogs, which were called Tullys, all right? And so he got a dog named Moss from Mark Tully and bred Kelpie with her and got a few litters out of her. And then all these local fellows, the right people, the right place, the right dogs, the right time. It's never happened before, and it will probably never happen again. But they developed this superior type of sheepdog, just like down on the Riverina. I'll breed this one with that one. And they were clever men. They knew what they were looking for. But they had the benefit of sheepdog trials, which would then really put that dog out on public notice, like how good was these dogs. And those dogs were excelling. So from Moss and Gleeson's Kelpie, they got King's Kelpie, all right? So another Kelpie, well, they called her Kelpie's daughter. So it was old Kelpie and young Kelpie, or Kelpie and Kelpie's daughter. And then she won a big trial at Forbes. Well, she tied with a dog called Tweed from Tasmania at the time. But that really established them as being superior workers. So everyone then wanted Kelpie's pups. So we're calling them Kelpie's pups, until they just became known as Kelpies. And they could have just as easily been known as Tullys. The Tullys were really, really prominent with their dogs. But that type developed, that type of sheepdog developed into the greatest working dog the world's ever seen.
Well, what made it so good? How does it differ from a traditional collie dog?
The Kelpie's a really good problem solver. And he likes thinking for himself. You can send some Kelpies out of sight, and they might need to run 5 kilometres to find a mob, but they'll bring them back to you. Whereas the comparisons are always with the Border Collie, and the Border Collie is a brilliant dog in its own right. But the Border Collie is a dog that's traditionally sort of been raised on smaller holdings, working with a person with smaller mobs of sheep. So border collies are really great at obeying orders. You know, a South African border collie man said to our great Kelpie man, Tony Parsons, you give a border collie an order and it says, what next? And you give a Kelpie an order and it says, well, what for? Because they're Australian, Sarah. They like, they know better than the boss.
So a bit of projection here, or genuinely you think Kelpies have got a different kind of intelligence?
No, they've got this. They've been raised to work out their own problems, to work in different circumstances. So we look at that thing, oh, look how clever they are. They're working this. They're just responding to what their environmental challenges are at the time. But they can solve their own problems, and they don't mind making mistakes. Where border collies are perfectionists, right? The company doesn't care if he makes mistakes. He says, I'll just rub that out and fix it up later. I don't care about that.
I took my youngest son a little while ago to a sheepdog show, yeah. And the stockman who was running that said, now, the difference between a Kelpie and a collie is a Kelpie is 10% dingo. Is this true? Is there dingo in the Kelpie?
Let's explain that. The dingo had nothing to do with the development of the Kelpie. The dingo has, this is what the people who believe that theory need to get through their head, that the dingo has no working ability. It has destructive ability is about all it has. So the Kelpie was developed from Scottish working dogs, the best working dogs. The Scots have created the best dogs. Like anything the Scots have made is always a great dog. I don't think they've created a dud yet, the Scots, but The dingo was later put into the Kelpie. Some of the great Kelpie men have admitted that they have put dingo into the Kelpie. This was in the 20th century, and people could have been doing anything anywhere with their strains, but generally as a breed, no. And science has now proven that when you cross any dog with a dingo, the skull and the makeup of that dog remains the same as a dingo because the genetics are so strong in a dingo to remain the same. Whereas the genetics in a domestic dog are designed to be changed. It's a very plastic and malleable genetic makeup in the domestic dog. So they always give way to the dingo. And if they don't, they don't survive in the Australian bush. To survive the wild, you've got to be built like a dingo, a wolf, a coyote, a jackal. They're all built the same. It's all the same prototype, just different sizes, and they fill different niches in different environments. But they've proven now, we've proven people who saw Gleason's Kelpie, reliable people said, oh, she's a Scottish working collie. Now, they knew what a dingo looked like. If she was part dingo, they would have said, that thing's a dingo. We're not going to put that anywhere near our sheep.
So the Kelpie and the Heeler become these quintessential Australian working dogs, yes. Guy. Looking at other breeds, has there ever been a breed that was banned from Australia? Any dog that we said not allowed?
Well, we didn't say it, but yes. The German Shepherd dog, or known then as the Alsatian Wolf dog, was banned from Australia for 45 years.
45 years?
Yeah, shameful, really, really.
Why?
And embarrassing. Because Australia's great dog authority, the man who's set everyone off on the wrong foot and filled us all full of misinformation, decided that if they escaped from their Sydney show rings and crossbred with a dingo, they would destroy the Australian wool industry. So there were 60 of them in Australia.
Well, that'd be these wild, uncontrollable monster dogs.
Yes, that's right. So Kolesky, being Robert Kolesky, decided that if they crossed, so if a large Alsatian crossed with a small dingo, you would get a supersized, bloodthirsty killer, not a dog that might be halfway between both of the parents. So he got the farmers' groups all stirred up about it, and they all lobbied the federal government and the state governments. And there was an interim ban for 5 years while they did nothing, and then they banned the dog for another 40 years. It wasn't until the Whitlam government allowed the importation, reversed it. They just got rid of it, realised how stupid it was, and prepared to listen to reason. Big Wool had, you know, held everyone to ransom, the government for ransom, with the Conservative governments for years and years and years, except for that small period during the Second World War when there was a Labor government.
During this time, the police started to use Alsatians because they're such amazing dogs to train. Tell me about the police Alsatians, particularly Tess and Zoe.
Well, those dogs were incredible dogs, but they were lucky. Their trainer was a man named Scotty Denham. Scotty Denham was a policeman. There's another Scot. The Scots and dogs in Australia are an incredible story. He had those dogs do, to cut a long story short, we're running short of time, but he had those dogs doing anything. Zoe could drive her own car.
What do you mean?
Now, well,
Zoe could
drive
her own car.
She had a car. She had a car licence. She went to the domain and did a car, sat for a car licence and passed. They used to give her commands, remote commands, and she used to drive the car. She used to push pedals and steer the car and everything. She flew a plane.
Guy, you're having me
no,
on.
No, I'm not having you on. But they kept it anchored to a central point so she could only fly in circles. She didn't want them doing a Kingsford Smith and heading over the Pacific. But yeah, she was capable of doing that. But he was fully convinced that she could actually fly that thing without it being tethered, but no one would trust him to do it. She raised lots and lots of money during the war for the war effort. She saved lost children. She caught felons, you know, and tested.
So they were used actually in police hunts, in search and
rescue.
Oh,
absolutely. Yeah, that was their main point. And in fact, there was a lot of pressure on Denham to use bloodhounds because the English were using bloodhounds. But he actually, there was a negative to the bloodhounds. If someone had jumped off a cliff, the bloodhound would want to follow him over the cliff. And so Scotty Denham had a few.
Well, the Alsatian could just fly its plane smoothly.
The Alsatian would just stop and go and just point over the edge of the cliff saying, down there. Work out another way to get down there. So they found that their tracking ability was just as good as the bloodhounds, and they were more able, they were more quick, like any hound. They're not particularly, they're not real team players, hounds. So they found them to be excellent, although they had health problems. A lot of them died early because there was a limited gene pool because of that ridiculous and shameful ban. But it lasted a long time, but New South Wales set the standard for police dog training and service dog training.
Guy, your knowledge of dogs has astonished me, and the thought of little Zoe driving her car or flying her aeroplane is going to stay with me all day. Thank you so much for
You're
being
welcome.
My guest on Conversations.
Thank you.
I spoke to Guy last year about his book, The Dogs That Made Australia. This conversation will be up on our website soon, abc.net.au/conversations, and you can listen to it again there or wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.